It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. It's been called a treatment of last resort, performed only after other forms of treatment have failed. We discuss the journey of amputation and medical advancements. The nonprofit Amputee Coalition says more than 2 million people live with limb loss. Most of those surgeries are lower limb due to vascular disease, and my mom included, by the way, in that statistic. Join in on your journey with an amputation, prognosis, surgical advancements, 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Dr. Taylor Reif is here, orthopedic surgeon at Hospital for Special Surgery, or HSS, in New York, member of its Limb Lengthening and Complex Reconstruction Service. Dr. Reif, welcome to the Ideas Network.
All right, thanks for having me.
Well, you specialize in the reconstruction of bones affected by tumors and cancers. What advancements have you seen in the reconstructive process?
Yeah, so I think we use whatever tools we have available to reconstruct bones that have been affected by cancer or malignancy. And one of the more recent advances and something that I specialize in is reconstructing that bone with the patient's own bone, including using a method called distraction osteogenesis, which is basically slowly pulling apart the patient's bone in order to form their own bone into that segment that was affected by a tumor. And this is a really a more durable way to reconstruct a patient who's had bone loss, because the bone is alive. It's the patient's own bone. So once it's all healed, it should last, you know, the rest of the patient's life.
It sounds really painful, though, in recovery. Is it?
You know, the initial surgery, like any surgery, has some associated pain, you know, that we manage through kind of multimodal analgesia efforts. But then the actual process of growing the patient's bone back, it's done very slowly. So during this time, the patients are usually pretty comfortable and are on, you know, minimal pain medications.
How do you weigh, though, whether to repair that bone or repair a limb versus amputation? What goes into that decision?
Yeah, I think it's you have to weigh many factors, including, you know, what the pathology is you're dealing with, what the status of the limb was, you know, at the time of surgery, what the patient's wishes and desires are. I mean, I think most people, you know, do not want to lose a limb, and so we generally make every effort to save a limb if we think it's feasible and that we think there's a good technique in order to do it. But, you know, sometimes, you know, based on what I'm shown and what I see and sometimes what patients are living with, you know, I think sometimes an amputation just makes more sense. And that's always comes down to, you know, kind of a long conversation in the office here about what the patient's wishes and desires are.
I wonder, have techniques changed to make the residual limb more accepting of a prosthetic device?
Yeah, so there's actually been a pretty major advancement within the last 10 to 15 years when it comes to treating patients with a residual limb. And that is the technology called osseointegration. And that's a term that basically encompasses a piece of metal that is placed into the remaining bone, usually the femur or the tibia in the lower leg, and that the bone then grows onto the implant, which then can be directly attached to an external prosthetic. And this is a major advancement compared with the prior way, which was using a socket prosthetic, which just fit around the limb. Which was fine, and, you know, some patients function well with the socket, but also leads to kind of poor fit, sweating, ulceration, sores, poor joint range of motion. So there's a lot of reasons why, you know, a patient with an osseointegration that's, you know, directly in their bone and is skeletally anchored is going to function better and have a higher quality of life than a patient who's wearing a socket.
Wow, that's really amazing, because those sockets, I mean, they are so finicky, right? I mean, you have to have just the right number of socks to avoid the rubbing, and sores seem to be so common.
extremely finicky. I mean, I think the story we hear again and again is, a patient will be in my office saying, listen, I've been through 6 prosthetics. You know, I have a great prosthetist. You know, they've done everything they can. You know, we've played with this and that and this fit. I've had multiple shells. And they just can't seem to come to a place that they really have a good fitting, high functioning prosthetic. And so they're looking, they've heard about these new advancements and, you know, they're really looking for a different option.
If you're just joining us, we're talking about amputations with an orthopedic surgeon. Dr. Taylor Reif is here from the Hospital for Special Surgery. You can join in on your journey with an amputation, where you're at today, questions you have about the process, 800-642-1234. Dr. Reif, let's step back for a moment. What are the most common causes of limb loss?
So in this country, where luckily we tend to live a long time and have, healthy lives, we see a lot of limb loss in older patients as they start to develop diabetes and vascular disease. So that's probably the biggest proportion of patients. But we also see, a fair amount of amputations from oncologic or, cancer reasons. Trauma remains a high number of patients who have an amputation. So it really comes from a spectrum. Sometimes it's just congenital loss of a limb very early on in a patient's life. So it really is across a spectrum.
How common are lower extremity amputations among people who have diabetes?
Unfortunately, they're quite common. The longer a patient has diabetes, the numbers would suggest that their risk of an amputation continues to go up. This can definitely be modified if the diabetes is better controlled. If they have a treating, primary care doctor, endocrinologist who, helps them manage what their glucose or sugar levels are. This definitely decreases the risk that they'll need an amputation. But, diabetes and, having high sugars is very hard on the vasculature and will tend to lead to decreasing amounts of oxygen that will get to the limbs. And unfortunately, it will usually start distally in the fingers or toes. And at some point, an amputation is necessary.
What about compounding by peripheral arterial disease, the blockages of those blood vessels? Is that a huge risk when you combine that with diabetes?
Yeah, so that certainly plays a role. In those patients who have what we call metabolic syndrome, which is, a combination of high blood pressure, obesity, heart disease, diabetes, all of these things, kind of contribute to build up within the arteries and then a loss of blood flow and oxygen to the limbs.
When you look at the numbers, the Amputee Coalition saying now there are about 2 million people living with limb loss. By 2050, the number is expected to reach 3.6 million people. What is causing this increase?
Well, unfortunately, I think it's the American way of life in terms of our diet and a lack of exercise. I mean, I think a lot of it just comes down to fundamentals that, if we were able to eat a more plant-based diet and get more exercise, that, we would see less of this metabolic syndrome in our patients and less of these kind of chronic diseases that have become very common.
Orthopedic surgeon Dr. Taylor Reif with us, our guide to amputations, here to answer your questions on limb loss with the Hospital for Special Surgery in New York. Join in on overcoming challenges with limb loss, what you encountered from your surgery to rehab, 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We're discussing medical advancements, surgical interventions with limb loss, limb difference that we haven't talked about. The CDC says limb loss can occur due to trauma, infection, diabetes, vascular disease, cancer, other diseases. Some children are born with limb loss or limb differences. Join in with your story, your questions about an amputation surgery, 800-642-1234. Dr. Taylor Reif is an orthopedic surgeon, part of the Limb Lengthening and Complex Reconstruction Service at Hospital for Special Surgery, and stays with us. Let's bring on a call now. Mike is with us from Washington County. Mike, what is your story?
Yeah, I'm a Vietnam veteran. I was blown up in 1968, and I'm a bilateral amputee, right AK, left Symes. I started out in a socket that had a belt around my waist with a wool sock, and that was pretty uncomfortable. Didn't last long, and they came out with suction sockets in about 1970. After I was out for about 6 months out of the hospital, I've had one ever since. Yeah, you have issues with sweat here and there, but if you're careful and you pay attention to what's going on, your stump can really take a lot of abuse. And I've cut down 100-year-old oak trees, and I've fished and I hunt, and I've dragged deer out of the woods, and all kinds of things. So I just wanted to say something in support of the suction socket and the prosthetics that do a lot of work. I'm really interested in that thing the doctor was talking about putting a metal piece at the bottom of your femur. That would be an amazing thing that wasn't available to my time. But I just wanted to say that. I had a little problems with surgery when I was in the hospital in Philadelphia for about 9 months. I had a little infections and stuff, but once I got out, I just never stopped. I just kept going. And my other comment was, people with diabetes, I think, are in a whole different ballgame as opposed to being a healthy 73-year-old who still walks around and still fishes and take my grant. I mean, yeah. Just want to throw that in there.
Well, Mike, you have shared such an amazing story, and it is really uplifting to hear that. Dr. Reif, what would you add there about Mike's trajectory?
Yeah, I would agree with everything he said. I mean, I think if a patient is doing well with their sockets, and, you know, there are many out there who do, because he said the prosthetists really do amazing work, then we certainly are not trying to push them towards osseointegration. I think this is really generally for the patients who just aren't, you know, living the life they want to lead with their sockets. And I also agree that, you know, we have to be much more careful in a patient with diabetes who might have ongoing vascular disease, whether they're offered osseointegration, because, you know, they would be at higher risk for, you know, developing infections and things. Whereas, yeah, a healthy 73-year-old we can be a little bit more confident in. But, you know, even if someone is doing well on their sockets and maybe, you know, they do want to try to see a bump in their function, I think, you know, osseointegration can at least be, you know, a discussion. But certainly, I think if someone is happy with their socket, you know, there's no reason that they have to go away from that.
Mike was saying that their stump can take a beating. I'm just wondering, how do you get the residual limb exercise and healing and able to have that skin really strong and healthy?
Yeah, so I think some of it comes down to just good surgical technique and making sure that you leave the best tissue possible so that, you know, the stump can interact with the socket or around an osseointegration, you know, prosthetic. And so it's really, you know, a lot of it's done at the time of surgery, but then just making sure that, you know, patients, you know, afterwards continue to participate in therapy, you know, and kind of follow our instructions in terms of things they can and can't do.
Researchers are saying that about 8 out of every 10 people who lose a limb experience some degree of phantom pain. Can you describe this type of pain?
Sure. So phantom pain kind of comes in two forms. There's phantom sensation, which is extremely common. And really is, you know, the brain has neurons that were devoted to that section of the limb. They're still there. They will kind of get pruned with time after limb loss. And then there's phantom pain, which is kind of not only do you have that sensation, but it's really a painful sensation as well. And we do have methods to, you know, really decrease that pain. And again, a lot of that comes down to, you know, what we do at the time of surgery. I would say sort of gone are the days where a nerve is just transected and left to form a nasty, painful neuroma. And now we use techniques where the nerves are either tied together with other residual nerves in the leg, or that, you know, a piece of muscle is wrapped around the end of the nerve. And kind of both of these techniques have been shown to decrease, you know, the incidence of phantom limb pain. You know, and so if there is some residual phantom sensation, you know, most patients, they're not too bothered by that. But really, it's we're trying to go after decreasing the pain.
Do phantom sensations or phantom pain decrease over time, or is that case by case?
Yeah, they generally do decrease over time. You know, certainly it's variable among patients. But even if nothing is done, most patients will experience a decrease in their phantom sensation or pain over the first year, likely due to this pruning effect that happens with the neurons in the brain. But, you know, we obviously want to accelerate that process as much as we can.
If you're just joining us, we're talking with orthopedic surgeon Taylor Reif as we look at the process of amputations, the conversations about them, and the surgery itself. You can join in on what you've experienced, 800-642-1234. Dr. Reif, one of the big takeaways from the latest Amputee Coalition survey is that people living with limb loss say they need better pain management and improved sleep. There were other things that the survey found out. But these, you know, that seems like a world away from the surgical aspect of removing that tissue or that limb. And I'm wondering, how do you think about the effects such as those when you're weighing surgery or carrying out these life-altering procedures?
Yeah, so I think certainly better pain management, I think, does come down to a lot of that, I think, is surgical because, again, how we handle the nerves, how we handle the residual tissue, you know, how high, you know, sometimes making the amputation a little bit higher in order to, you know, maintain better tissue around, you know, the residual bone is actually going to be much better for them long term in terms of pain management. Some of the other techniques I just talked about in terms of how the nerves are managed, making sure those nerves have a target and a new muscle or nerve that they can grow to, will certainly decrease their long-term pain. The sleep issue, I think, is certainly difficult. You know, you'd really have to, I think, dig into that data to see, you know, what the effect is. I know, I mean, Americans in general, I think, suffer from poor sleep, and it may be higher among amputees, but you know, I think that's kind of a problem that probably has to be approached from several angles.
I want to tease that out for a moment as, you know, you go higher on a limb to get that better tissue, that better blood circulation. But that patient, too, has to accept that there might be more of the limb taken off. How do you approach that conversation?
Yeah, it's certainly hard. I think generally, especially when socket prosthetics predominated, you certainly wanted to leave as much limb as possible just because it was shown that, you know, then less oxygen consumption is used when, you know, a patient's ambulating. But fortunately, with osseointegration, the conversation has changed a little bit because those can function extremely well even with short limbs, even, you know, very short femoral segments, you know, that are close to the hip. You know, those patients are ambulating without assistance. So, you know, in my mind, you know, keeping a healthy envelope of skin, you know, is worth it because, you know, we see so many problems with, you know, residual tissue that can lead to, you know, returns to the OR if it's not healthy. So I think, you know, making sure that you leave them only with good tissue at the time of surgery is extremely important.
Let's bring in Nick and Madison. Nick, go ahead.
Hi, I used a technique as a physical therapist for quite a few years with people with phantom pain. What I would do is put a large mirror in between the patient's two knees, and if they look from an angle, they would looking down, it looks just like the other limb is still there. It's not a mirror image. It's exactly what you would look at because the brain is trying to find that limb and sending too many impulses, and I had really good success with it.
Nick, thank you for that. Dr. Reif, what about the mirror approach?
Yeah, mirror therapy is a great technique and something that our therapists definitely utilize here too. I couldn't tell you exactly how it's working in the brain other than, you know, it is somehow retraining the brain to kind of accept that loss of limb by, you know, getting an image of the opposite limb.
And very quickly, because we're out of time here, how soon after a surgery can someone be able to get fitted for a prosthetic device?
For a socket prosthetic, it generally takes a month or two while the incision and the other tissues kind of heal and decrease their swelling. For osseointegration, they can actually be fitted with a prosthetic even sooner because, the implant can be installed at the time of surgery.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it can be as soon as, you know, a few weeks that they're, you know, kind of training their new limb in a prosthetic.
Dr. Reef, thank you for joining us.
Yes, thank you for having me.
Dr. Taylor Reef, orthopedic surgeon at the Hospital for Special Surgery in New York. Up ahead, a Wisconsin-based certified prosthetist answers your questions about replacing limbs with artificial devices. 800-642-1234. News update is next on the Ideas Network. It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. The Amputee Coalition just published the results of the largest survey to date of people with limb loss and limb difference. And they said until recently, little was known about the more than 2 million people with these challenges accessing care. Respondents said their top physical health priorities were strength and balance, improved assistive device performance and comfort, and access to a prosthesis. Join in on artificial limbs, questions, and experiences, 800-642-1234. Amy Palios is a certified prosthetist with the Orthotics and Prosthetics Clinic at UW Health, specializing in lower limb amputations and prosthetics. Amy, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Good morning. Good. Nice to be here.
Good morning. So, you know, in specializing in lower limb amputations and prosthetics, how often do patients with limb loss ultimately get an artificial replacement, a prosthetic?
That's a great question. I would say a majority do, certainly. The eligibility to receive a prosthesis basically comes down to whether the patient has the means and the desire to use it and if it would be of benefit to them. When we consider whether somebody's a candidate, we're really primarily concerned about their safety. And generally speaking, having a prosthesis will make somebody more safe rather than less safe. It's certainly easy to understand how balancing on two limbs would be easier than balancing on one. However, if the patient has cognitive issues or serious skin issues or edema, which is a carrying water within the limb and is not an appropriate candidate, we sort of try to troubleshoot those things if possible before we consider making something for them. But a majority, I would say, I guess I'm a little bit biased because a majority of the patients I see are referred to me because they are candidates.
Sure.
Once in a while, we have to carefully sort of explain that they don't meet the criteria. One widely misunderstood fact is that a prosthesis will not help somebody stand up from a chair. If that makes sense, it's something that the body has to be able to do on the remaining limb. Or if somebody's a bilateral or a two lower limb amputee, they need the upper body strength to push themselves up to standing with their upper body. And sometimes somebody might not be capable of doing that and may need to work on that first before they are truly a candidate for prosthetic fittings.
Going a little bit deeper on that means and desire in that person, I know my mom had a heightened risk of falling after her first amputation. And how do therapists account for that in the rehab with the prosthetic? I mean, she got really afraid to try out that new mobility, just not fully trusting the device.
Absolutely. That's a common thing. And the answer to that is physical therapy, and occupational therapy. I'm blessed to work with an amazing therapy team that meets somebody wherever they're at, wherever they're beginning, and helps them understand that this is something that can make them more confident, more safe if they know how to handle it. but that is not an easy thing to teach somebody if they're inherently nervous about standing up and not trusting something where they can't feel that foot on the ground. Therapy is everything when it comes to convincing somebody or, you know, helping them understand that it can be beneficial. It's not something that comes naturally to everybody.
We are talking about the surgical advancements earlier and the implants. What breakthroughs are you seeing in your area of prosthetic devices?
With regard to, say, osseointegration?
Well, the equipment themselves, and fit and customization and things like that.
Right. So the interface within the prosthesis, which I think you and I spoke about last time, which is a gel liner, is a soft sort of clingy silicone or urethane or thermoplastic elastomer interface that rolls onto the limb and is extremely innate and soft and protective. Those have been around for a long, long time, but they're still coming out with variations of those gel liners that make people more accepting or tolerant of them. One of the things that comes to mind immediately is how hot people get within their prostheses. And there are various gels that do better with body temperature and controlling how the temperature of the limb within that liner, for example. So materials are constantly advancing. I mean, I could spend a full hour talking about how technology is advancing and the various feet and knees that we deal with. But surgical techniques, I think osseointegration is the number one, and I know you hit on it in the previous specialist. Osseointegration is on the horizon. I'm anxious for it to become something that we see in Wisconsin. It's absolutely not for a huge majority of the population. It's a very specific patient that is a candidate for osseointegration, but I think it's on the horizon. I think it's going to likely start to become something we see more often in the last decade or two that I'm going to be practicing, which makes me more excited for that option for people. So I think that's and then 3D printing is the other big advancement.
Oh, yes. I want to talk about 3D printing in a bit, but the osseointegration, when that implant is there, does that mean that the device that is connected then to the residual limb can't be taken off, or can it come off and be put on like a normal prosthetic device?
Yeah, the latter. Absolutely the latter. Okay. So the implant itself, the implant itself remains attached to, generally speaking, this is a solution we're talking about for above the knee amputees or transfemoral level amputees, where hardware is actually implanted within the femur and extends out through the skin surface. And then there is an attachment external to the body, which attaches to the prosthetic device, which can be removed anytime it needs to be. But that's the beauty of it. It's it's not something that envelops a whole external surface of the body. It's physically attached to the anatomical build of within the body, which is a huge advantage when it comes to the problems that amputees deal with, specifically transfemoral or above the knee amputees. One of the hugest complaints is how high the socket has to come up onto the body and envelop the limb, and how uncomfortable that is to basically be putting weight through the bottom of your seat bone or the ischial tuberosity, which is not an easy thing to deal with, specifically when somebody's sitting down. They're sitting then on a hard surface. And so osseointegration would afford somebody this external fixation to the prosthetic device and give them physical control over the extension of their body, essentially, and have much stronger proprioception or feeling of what that limb is doing, because it's attached directly physically to their skeleton.
Oh, I see. So thank you for expanding on that primer there. Amy Palios with us talking about artificial limb replacements, a certified prosthetist at UW Health specializing in lower limb amputations and prosthetics. You can join in with your questions, your story, 800-642-1234. Amy, you mentioned 3D printing technology and how that is changing prosthetic medicine. Can you describe what you're seeing out there?
Absolutely. So, excuse me, 3D printing is basically the ability of any design to be laid down one bead or one layer at a time and built up from any surface. And it affords such unique shaping and customization of sockets. So the socket is the term that we referred to that fits on the anatomical part of the body that's left, and the socket is what is attached to the components called like a knee or a foot. So the socket itself is what is being 3D printed now with an amazing amount of prevalence. And I would say the ability for that to happen and happen quickly is a huge advantage. So not to get too deep into the weeds, but when we create a socket at our lab, we're taking a flat sheet of plastic and we're vacuum forming that around a positive model of the limb that I've essentially shaped and carved and worked with, shaping with my hands a model of plaster. And so it's several different steps. It's taking a cast of the patient's residual limb, filling that cast with plaster, shaping or molding that with my hands, and then taking this flat sheet of plastic to vacuum form it around that positive model. So there's several steps in that. Those middle steps, which are, I guess some would call it old school now because of 3D technology, you can scan a residual limb with technology of a digital scanner, get a computer image on a screen of the model, a 3D screen, so you can switch the angle with which you're looking at it. You can turn it around and look at it from every angle. You can essentially modify that cast digitally instead of having your hands dirty.
Wow.
And then you can send that image to your 3D printer and have the 3D printer lay down plastic beading around and around and around until it comes up with a then negative model or a socket to fit the limb. And all of that can be done with much less waste, much less time, and it's a much cleaner process. So a lot of what we call check sockets, which is a term for the first fitting prototype that we put on a patient's limb, a lot of check sockets now are being made by 3D printing because, again, those steps that I mentioned that go into creating the socket, a few of them can be eliminated, and that it saves a ton of time and a ton of money and a ton of mess, I guess you could say.
It sounds like
when you have it 3D printing.
It sounds like 3D is here to stay. It has it gone mainstream? Would you find it in clinics all over or only in specialized places?
That's a great question. I think it is considered mainstream within certain companies. I think companies across like national corporations are probably starting to use it more frequently because they see the cost benefit analysis of doing that with less mess, less material, and getting it done faster, essentially, without all those steps in the middle. It is here to stay. It absolutely is. It's just being refined. And it's getting wider. It's being spread out across the country. But many of my colleagues at various offices use 3D printing now.
UW Health certified prosthetist Amy Palios fielding questions about amputations, prosthetics, the advancements in technology. Join in on fit, on function, what you've learned through your trajectory with an amputation. 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. The NIH, the National Institutes of Health, says there's an epidemic of amputations in our country disproportionately affecting people with diabetes. About 200,000 Americans have amputations each year, and about 130,000 of those people are living with diabetes. Join in with your story about life after limb loss, your experience with an artificial limb, what that has been like. 800-642-1234. Prosthetist Amy Palios stays with us. Amy, you're talking about, waste and time, cost and materials. And I'm just wondering, as we've seen the global supply chain backlogs, are people waiting longer than in the past? As at this point with the pandemic and inflation disruptions, as they are trying to get their prosthetic device?
Not anymore. I would say if you had asked me that 6 months ago, 8 months ago, 10 months ago, my answer would have been different. But it seems like the kinks in the supply chain, at least for the materials we use, have worked themselves out. Fortunately, there was a time when we were having quite a wait time on certain prosthetic feet, much longer than expected. Usually it takes 10 to 14 days for us to have something in hand from whichever vendor it's coming from. And that had doubled for a while. It was very frustrating, to say the least, for us to be ready to fit somebody but not have the components we needed that had been ordered for them. But fortunately, it seems that a lot of the wait times have dissolved. And I think it was all supply chain related because of COVID.
When you look at components today, are they more representative of a person's real, body size, body structure? Do they look more authentic to the person that they are on?
Another good question. I would say the cosmetic part of things hasn't changed a whole lot. Hmm. One thing that's not well understood, there's a couple different ways to answer that. One thing that's not well understood is that, generally speaking, the internal components of a prosthesis are variable and essentially get covered up with a cosmetic cover. If you're talking about creating a shaped, an anatomical shape to match maybe the sound side leg, mm-hmm. that is a matter of soft materials like foam and then a flexible outer skin covering. So when you see a patient wearing a prosthesis that you don't even realize is a prosthesis, that's a really well done job by a prosthetist who took the time, or a technician took the time, to shape the cover of those inside components and make it look like the other leg, and then applied what we call a flexible outer skin covering. That flexible outer skin covering, absolutely, those have come a long way in matching skin tone and having a much more realistic look than they used to, where it was just a matter of like cosmetic stockings to cover up a lower limb. Now we have these amazing color swatches where I hand the patient, a variety of swatches, almost like picking out your carpet or your curtains, and they can look at skin tone and look at it compared to the other leg or their arm and pick which color matches them the best. There are not that many choices of foot shells, which is the shell that covers up a carbon fiber foot component. They basically come in, light, dark, and in between. And that's really disappointing when we have somebody that doesn't have, just one of those colors. I wish we had a myriad of options. But generally speaking, at least the to cover up the calf muscle, or the cover that covers the calf muscle and looks like that, or the ankle, we do have flexible skin covers that cover up those components. That said, I would say so many patients now that come to me versus 15 years ago don't care. Mm-hmm.
That
has been one.
They want to show
shift,
off.
I think
show
yes.
off. The,
yeah, they
the
we yeah we say yeah we say they're going to say it loud, say it proud that they're an amputee. They do not. It certainly, I truly mean, not as many people want their prosthetic device covered up with a cosmetic cover to look like their other limb as was the case 15 years ago. Many more people let their endoskeletal components, you know, the pipe or the pylon and the ankle and the foot, be shown. Mm-hmm. And I don't know if it's, I think that there's just much more awareness due to the prevalence of the Paralympics and all the attention that gets, which I've, of course I love. Mm. And I think that people's eyes are open to the, to body differences and acceptance a lot more so perhaps than they used to be. I think some, my patients tell me sometimes the only reason they wish they had a cosmetic cover is because they just don't want the stares from people or the curiosity. Hmm. They'd rather just have the person look them in the face. But that said, plenty of personalities in my patients are glad to talk to whomever wants to ask a question about their prosthesis. And, you know, the patients want to show off how they're living on and doing their things. And it's really exciting, I think, to just see that more acceptance, more pride in body differences and limb differences that has changed certainly in my career.
As you get, you know, you're kind of allowing us to peek inside this world of creating these devices. And it's just so amazing how you're able to merge artistry with the engineering and the precision. It also speaks to probably why these are so expensive. What can you say about the cost?
Yeah, I can say a lot about the cost. So one thing that's not well understood about the payment for a prosthesis, and this is a very goofy way of getting paid for what we do. Whereas when you go into the doctor's office or you go to a physical therapy appointment or you go to perhaps a variety of medical professionals, they're able to bill their time for the amount of time spent with you. That is not the case when it comes to what we do. So everything from the minute we start working with a patient to the time spent with the doctor in prescription, to the ordering of the components, to the casting of the limb, to the fitting of the patient, walking them, fabrication, shipping that stuff where it needs to go, building it, and then finishing it and delivering it, and then 90 days of follow-up. And I could go on and on with more details about what goes into it. But all of that is wrapped into the cost of a prosthesis. It's not a well understood that every single minute and every single bit of time and all those materials are actually what goes into the price of a prosthesis. And then, you know, so we're not getting paid for the amount of time that we spend doing this. We're paid for all of that wrapped up into the cost of a prosthetic device, if that makes sense.
Yes,
so the components themselves. So the components themselves are certainly thousands of dollars, but that's only one portion of what goes in. Yeah, that's only one portion of what goes into the price tag of a prosthesis. And that's something that's not well understood when it comes to when people ask, well, how much does this cost? And you say, well, probably between $7,000 and $28,000. They want to fall over, and I would too, but it's not well understood that that's an all-encompassing price tag, and all-inclusive of every minute of every aspect that's being put into that, and that the insurance companies don't pay that. They're deeply discounted when it's a contractual agreement between an insurance company and a medical provider.
Amy,
they're not paying that price tag.
Amy, thank you for joining us.
Of course, I'm happy to.
Amy Palios, certified prosthetist with the Orthotics and Prosthetics Clinic at UW Health in Madison. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network.